from the show a couple weeks, and so we're back with a vengeance. It's almost a full hour of programming this morning. We've got lots to talk about, including fertilizing, what to do, what to restart, but we wanted to open with a conversation about slugs.
Oh, yes. They're kind of the nonstop beast of the world. And I'm still feeling pretty lucky out here, but I know that that situation can change. But there's a lot of different ideas about how to control slugs and what we should do about slugs. And we've been recommending Sluggo for quite some time, and I still feel like that's pretty reasonable. But I have heard some discussion about Sluggo also being toxic to earthworms, so there could be some concerns about using Sluggo. So wanted to maybe talk about that and present some thoughts about alternatives.
Great. We always like alternatives, and I think it's always wise to consider when you apply something to your garden for a reason, there are usually consequences that you didn't intend, even when you're completely assured that everything's fine and it's benign. So I think it's always good to keep that in mind. Just as an aside, for years, Roundup was considered safe, and a lot of people used it. It is an herbicide, and it's not that great. And it's really somewhat rapidly moving into the category of do not use for a variety of reasons. But anyway, we're talking about slugs and Sluggo. And prevention is always great and perfect and means you aren't applying anything to your garden. The change to a really rainy, misty weather pattern means the slugs are out not only in the wee hours, but a lot of the daytime too.
It's pretty happy weather for slugs right now. I mean, they are all over the place. When I walk on the boardwalk and the trail, they are just cruising around. I mean, I have to actively try not to step on them. So what do you do about them in your garden? Is always, I think it's going to be a few strategies. And I know this first one you've heard both of us say a bunch of times, and that is basically go out there and watch and pick, you know, morning, noon, and night, or at least once a day, and remove them from your garden. And by remove, I don't mean go put them in, you know, an adjacent garden. You probably have to murder them. I'm sorry.
Yeah. One of the things that I'm noticing now is that they've hatched. And that means particularly for me in my greenhouse, I have a lot of tiny slugs. And so they're not that noticeable until I really get down there amongst the leaves and pay attention. Obviously, the little nibble holes alert you, but sometimes those early nibblings are so small because it's such a tiny thing. And if you can kind of be methodical and work through and really pay attention to those little ones, you're going to prevent them obviously becoming the big ones that can, you know, reduce a plant to something that it's not like overnight. I mean, the little ones don't, you know, do that much, but it's the idea that they're going to be the big ones that's the problem.
So I don't want to say not to use Sluggo, but maybe use it a little bit more thoughtfully. You know, maybe not just like use tons of it. One, you know, it's not free. So that will slow down your cost. But yeah, just think about, well, you know, what's the balance? And I haven't seen like, you know, an actual like experiment. Okay, we've got a bed with slugs and earthworms and we add Sluggo and what happens. I haven't seen that yet, but that doesn't mean it's not out there. It would be an interesting little experiment to do.
Yeah, we're kind of waiting on the research. So, you know, that's always the way what we go with is the science. One way to reduce the amount of Sluggo is to really work on cleaning out your raised bed and then use your Sluggo around the margin of your bed or at the base of the boards so that hopefully you're getting those slugs before they roll into your garden. So, you know, the space that you can clear out is good. And yeah, I think we have a caller. I'm not sure yet if we're going live or if it's a question, but we do have a call coming in, so that's great. So yeah, prevention is always the thing. The other thing is if you look through your garden, figure out which are the things that get attacked first by slugs. There's always these preferential plants, mm-hmm. and they'll kind of they'll kind of tell you that you have that you have them.
You have a slug problem.
Yeah, exactly. Hello, you're on the Garden Show.
Hi, this is Toby Campbell, and I've been listening to all of the slug information. And, I think I do have some active slugs. There is something that is eating my rhododendron and my rhubarb leaves, in kind of in a certain area, and it doesn't look like it's slug activity. I can't figure out what it might be, and I wondered if you had any thoughts about that.
Well, there is, I believe, is it a sawfly infestation we're suffering, Kitty? I forget the name of the insect that is going after root.
There are a couple of, there's a sawfly that's specific to currants, but there are other different kinds of flies that will attack, or different kinds of insects that will, in fact, attack rhododendrons, and, of course, rhubarb. But it's always best if you can actually figure out what the critter is and find it. And sometimes I'm like trying to, it's like you have to kind of look carefully. And I'm almost wondering if you could almost apply like some sort of, this is going to sound crazy, like sticky tape, like double stick tape or something on the bottom side of the leaves. I know that sounds nuts, but you also use like insect traps that are sticky in greenhouses. And maybe there's a way to put one of those like little insect sticky traps kind of in a place with your rhododendron leaves that you might actually be able to catch the critter in action. Because having the critter is going to make it easier to kind of figure out how do I approach this? And in the end, there's probably only so many things you're going to want to do to get rid of it, right? So it's like, for most of us, it's like, well, is it going to be water? Is it going to be soapy water? Some kind of spray? Mm-hmm. Are we going to rub the leaves with something? But still, knowing what it is, it's important.
Toby, is it the lower leaves on your rhododendron by chance?
It's kind of all over.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. Yeah. And Kitty mentioned the currants, and actually something has just started. You know, last year it was like the whole bush, but this year it's just some of the leaves they look like they're being eaten. And so I wondered if there was something specific also.
I've been like monitoring my, it's probably a different beast that's eating the two plants. That current thing that will just like completely like eat all the leaves. So they just like little skeletons on the currants.
Yeah.
It's kind of horrifying. I've been trying to really stay on that. And I use it's horticultural ultralight oil. I've been spraying on them. Sometimes I'll also alternate with soapy water. But they do so much damage that I've kind of like gone pretty proactive with the current. My rhododendron is big enough that it's like I don't defend it quite as rigorously, but I don't have the same problem you do right now. But, you know, the soapy, mixed soapy water works pretty well. And maybe double check with that ultralight if it's okay with rhododendrons. I can do that right now, even.
With the soapy water thing? Or the
soapy water is probably just fine.
And this isn't a bad time to do soapy water because it'll rain and rinse for you. I mean, you want the soap to get on your pest, but you also, the plants kind of like it if they get their soap rinsed off eventually.
Right, right. Okay, and the oil that you mentioned, where does one get that?
I have bought it in town at I suspect both garden stores have it. So I've definitely bought it here. I haven't had to like order it from someplace else.
And I
found it really handy for when only a few times I've had aphids so bad I kind of resorted to it. You know, usually I do the soapy water first, but then it's like, oh my God, all right, going for the big guns.
Yeah, so horticultural oil.
Okay, great. Thank you so much.
It's very light oil, so it's, it's not like spraying, you know, diesel on your plants.
Right, exactly. All right, well, thank you so much for your help. I appreciate it.
Thanks for your call. Good luck with it.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Yeah, that It's a European sawfly that's been on the currents, and it is gnarly bugger. But yeah, I've only noticed it here in town maybe 2 years ago, and it completely defoliated both wild, the large stink currants that are gray currants, people call them too, and my black currants. Was not happy with that beast.
Right. These are tough times with those guys. So thanks for your call. We are taking calls this morning. 747-5877 is the number. And we'd love to hear from you. We're sort of talking about pests, and we were wanting to dive in on the slug issue because that seems pretty pretty clearly a problem for a lot of people right now. Prevention, of course, that's what we always say, and hand picking. And then I just was talking about this idea of looking for the plants that they target first. So for me, it's the bok choys. Those are really rough as far as slugs go. And then dill is another one that's really attractive to slugs. And the tiny ones can defoliate that in no time.
Oh, yeah. The leaves are really small. So I just watched something kind of interesting on YouTube in the last hour or so. Someone's little home experiment comparing kind of the, let's call it the barrier method of slug prevention. So they kind of make a circle around the plant with some sort of material, whether it's coffee grounds or eggshells or diatomaceous earth, or I think the fourth one they put was paprika, which I don't quite get, but okay. And so they made these little circles of the substance, and then they had a like a pool of small slugs, and they put four of them in each center of each circle to see if they would cross the material, see what would happen.
Okay.
And I am really sad to say that in every case those slugs like crossed that material. But you could try that for yourself, you know, at home. Here's a couple of different things I want to try. I want to see if they actually work. And if you have slugs in your garden, you no doubt have plenty to experiment with. so see what actually helps and makes a difference. You have the power to test this.
Yeah. Sounds like a slug rodeo going on. Very amusing. The other thing that I think is always good to remember is something that works in one place doesn't always work in another place. And so, you know, what works for you may be specific to you and your situation. Around raised beds, the other thing is weeding out the greenery. In my case, the weeds that are coming around the raised beds will help keep the slugs down. And because you're just removing that area where they're hanging out and crawling up in to nibble the things that they really want to get to, which are your vegetables in your garden. And then the other thing to keep in mind, of course, is that the black beetles are slug eaters, and so are the birds in your garden. And so those are both what we call beneficials, things that are there and are helpful to you just as they're living their everyday lives.
Yeah, no. So I do as much as I can to encourage a kind of healthy, happy little environment for the birds and for other insects. And I mean, I realize that I might have an advantage because of those newts that are out here that are also eating probably slug eggs and maybe small slugs. But encouraging all these other critters, and by encouraging it, I mean the easiest way to do it is to not use poisons in your garden, of course, and then to have a variety of different kinds of plants and habitats. So having a few shrubs, having a tree or two, or you know, herbaceous plants, just having those variety of habitats for animals to use, particularly these little pest eating animals, is quite happy.
So a small rock, a shell overturned, an orange or a grapefruit rind, those are ways to provide a mini habitat that's easy to check and remove slugs from. You could just have those around the margin of your garden as well. And then, of course, there are the dish with beer in it. There's lots of ways to do those kind of traps that don't involve actually applying anything to your plants or your garden bed.
Right. So you could have, especially if you have like a covered, if you use Remay or some sort of spun row cover over your beds, then you have a way to actually keep that trap liquid not very dilute, right? So you've had your little bowl that's either flush or, you know, tipped over so it can get, the slugs can easily get into that beer. I think you can also use kind of a yeasty sugary mix if you don't want to use beer. But at any rate, that way that material will not get diluted by rain, and you can, it might be more effective that way under the Remay.
Okay, so I think we have a call coming in, and we are ready to go with that. Hello, you're on the Garden Show.
Hi, Kitty and Molly. This is Robin Sherman.
Hi, Robin.
Hello.
I was calling in. I've already gotten some advice online from Kitty about the cup fungus taking over my garden bed. And I understand that it's not harmful, and I've removed some of it. But I'm wondering if I can put it in the compost?
That's a good question. How hot is your compost is my first question for you.
It's not that hot.
Well, when you're doing a passive compost, which means you're not working at it to get it really hot. And I approve of this behavior because I think it's often we want to spend our energy on our garden and not our compost. So it's all fine. I would not necessarily put it in your compost then.
Because it'll probably spread it.
Well, the hyphae, which is the actual body, you know, the cup part of the fungus is actually the sort of the fruiting body, and there's all sorts of it running around in the soil of your garden, no doubt. And so that's what will just continue to grow if your compost provides it with a nice environment. You could mix it and stir it, add things, but yeah, I don't think I would put it in my compost. What do you think, Kitty?
Well, you will just give it more food to grow on, basically. So the spores are going to come out of those cups, and they will maybe find a good place to germinate in your compost and keep growing in there. Now, they're decomposers, so they, you know, necessarily in the compost, they're not going to cause too much of an issue, probably. But on the other hand, you're just making more, I guess. So it's probably not a huge deal, but you know, you can easily just toss those little cup fungi off into the woods or into the bushes, and you know, they're not, you know,
right.
They're not going to cause a problem out there. So, and I would just keep removing the fruiting bodies from the bed, because it really did look like in the photo you posted that there was actually, you know, they're kind of pushing aside the things you wanted to grow.
Yes, exactly. They're choking out small, you know, the big plants I think will be okay, but there's so much of it that it is choking out little seedlings.
Yeah, I just like take a little knife, if you need to, and just, you know, even scissors, and just, you know, it takes a while, obviously. It's not a fast job, but it just seems like it's worthwhile removing them just for space consideration.
Okay. Thank you so much.
If as you're thinning or weeding, you might try adding a little sand if you had it, and disrupting the surface area to see if you can make that slightly less appealing to that fungus to use that exact area by your small seedlings and plants.
So just or a little lime.
Oh, lime. Yeah, that's a good idea.
Yeah.
Let's try that. Great. Thank you so much.
All right. Thanks for your call.
Bye-bye.
Yeah, there's a lot of decomposing fungi that show up, and they're mostly not going to harm your plants because they don't have the ability necessarily to be pathogens, so they're not actually infecting live tissue. But still, they can really displace other critters if you just get this mat of them. So that's when it's worthwhile removing them. You know, a single mushroom or, you know, fruiting body or two isn't going to really be a big thing, but...
And we rely on fungus to help break down the things that are in the soil and release the micronutrients to be available to the other plants. So it's not like they're a bad thing unless they're sort of out of control. It's just isn't that a maxim for life? Okay.
Yes.
So I wanted to change the subject a little bit. If we're done with slugs, Kitty, what do you think?
I think probably so. I mean, wait, I did have one more thing. Sorry. There's always more about slugs. I kept reading because I was like, okay, if I'm going to tell people not to just use Sluggo, what am I going to tell them to do?
Good point.
Especially, you know, it's like, okay, try this barrier thing, test it with your local slugs and see if anything you're using actually makes a difference. The other thing I was reading about is actually taking, like, you know, a regular cup of coffee, diluting that with water, putting it in a spray bottle, and spraying it around your plants, and actually even on your plants. Dilute coffee, because that slugs don't like caffeine.
Oh, interesting.
And I saw that mentioned in a few different places. Again, check it out. You know, don't, you know, go wholesale and say, Kitty said this would work. Absolutely. Kitty's not saying that. Kitty's saying check it out on different plants and seeing how it goes.
All right.
You've got lots of time, right? There's no social life right now. We can do lots of garden experiments.
Right. Absolutely. We have nothing better to do than brew coffee and spray it on our garden plants. Actually, one of the things you probably may want to do soon is fertilize a few of the things that you are growing. So a lot of the spring blooming plants are done, and you probably have your annuals that you potentially planted in pots and around the edges of your garden coming on and looking great. And so what that means is that they have reached in and depleted the soil of some of the nutrients. And so this is a great time to fertilize. Of course, I'm going to talk about rhododendrons and fertilizing rhododendrons. It's a tiny bit early, unless you have rhododendrons that were super early bloomers and they're already finished. But as we get into July, it's going to be a great time to do your second and probably last round of fertilizer for rhododendrons. But there's lots to think about specifically in terms of, have you fertilized your fuchsia or your hanging basket of annuals?
Yeah, so what I tend to do when I go through my garden beds, both my vegetables and my flowers and my baskets, but in particular with the vegetables, is I'll, you know, pull off the Rime, check the weeding. There's always some weeding, you know, little chickweeds and things like that. So I get rid of those. And then I'll usually put, this year I'm trying this granulated chicken manure that I got. One, because who wants to carry wet manure a half a mile, right?
Right.
So I've used this granulate, but I don't use very much. I just put like a little circle, and it's a very loose light circle, kind of in the drip line of each of my plants. And then I cover up the plants back again. This year I'm trying a little diatomaceous earth in there just to see, because it's dry in there, to see if that at least slows down the few slugs I do have.
Right. So if you're not sure what we mean by the drip line, on a shrub, it's probably the easiest to think about. So if you think about your rhododendron and it has all of its beautiful leaves, and underneath of it is inside the drip line. So that drip line is the place where the plant literally, if it just had a light sprinkling, drips down onto the ground. And inside that is usually a lot drier. And oftentimes the roots are about out to the drip line on a plant or a shrub. So that's what we mean by the drip line, and that's a great place to fertilize things.
Yeah, so this year I'm using mostly that granulated chicken manure, but otherwise I'll have a mix of bone meal and blood meal, and just kind of mix that up in a yogurt container usually, and I'll sprinkle a little bit of that around. Just something to give them a little boost. I mean, we ask a lot of our vegetables. We really want them to go, right? We want a lot out of them. So it takes some nutrients to do that big push of growth. And if you don't fertilize very much, and actually the other issue could be water, but that's another subject, your plants can start flowering before you want them to. So you want to have this big growth before you start putting on the buds for the broccoli or the buds for the cauliflower or whatever it is you're looking for.
Right. In the vegetable garden, you want to maximize foliage, the green parts, before, either because that's what you want to eat in terms of spinach, lettuce, cilantro, kales, chards, all of those. Your goal is to eat the leaves and not to have the plant flower or bolt. And in the case of the crucifers, like the cauliflower, broccoli, Brussels, you want that robust plant to grow most of the season before it puts on its head that you're going to harvest. So that's the, Kitty, you're talking about primarily granular, applying granular fertilizers. So the question I think is worth answering is, when do we use liquid fertilizers? And is that a thing? And that's certainly a thing. And liquid fertilizers, I think, are perfect for containers, because those you don't have the soil room and you don't have much moving in the container. So you would just be relying on the water to take it down into the roots. And you'll be far more effective if you just water it down into the roots with liquid fertilizer. So fish fertilizer, or either look at the... Look at the numbers. There's three numbers for every fertilizer, and you want to check that and make a decision about what you're trying to accomplish. So if you're trying to accomplish flowering in your containers, then you want to use the fertilizer. They usually label it bloom food, and what that means is that the middle number is big. And and so for your annuals, or say your strawberries or your fuchsias, any number of those things, you're not looking for that plant to give you a lot of foliage. You want that plant to go to bloom. And so then you use a bloom version of fertilizer.
Yeah, I use a liquid fish fertilizer on my containers, both the fuchsia, and then I've got another container with some begonias in it, and then my tomatoes also are getting that. And I just mix a little bit in each time I water, so it's a pretty light, but the tomatoes are really pumping through a lot of water in the greenhouse, in the containers. So I kind of feel like they probably need kind of a steady, small dose of nutrients, just because they're not in a very big soil volume, and I'm very demanding of their behavior, so I need to feed them.
Right. I think I learned the lesson about liquid fertilizer many years ago, and I got a little aggressive with it, thinking, oh, well, we have a long day, and these plants are really growing, and they will, and they'll respond well to your fertilizer until the day they don't. And what happens is they'll sort of overgrow their whole capability of their container, and then they rot off at the root level and stem, because they've just like grown so robustly they can't support the plant. So what you're looking for is the balance. You can do Kitty's method, which is a very dilute fertilizer much of the time, or you can sort of mark your calendar and do a little more robust fertilizer less of the time. I try to think every 2 weeks for my hanging baskets and containers. And then I generally don't use quite as much as it says. I think holding back a little, you actually end up with a more even growth and a better outcome. Remember that the manufacturer is going to tell you the maximum you can use, because they want you to use your bottle up and buy another one. So finding kind of a balance on that, I think either way works well.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. And I don't think I ever put as much in as is called for. You know, even though I'm trying to dilute it, I probably dilute it even a little bit more. So it's fine. And then after a while, I notice the bottle of fish fertilizer gets kind of sludgy as well. So I will actually top that off with fresh water and give it a shake and go for it again. I still feel like there's plenty of nutrients that I'm adding. You know, sooner or later, I will run out of that bottle. But, you know, might as well get everything I can out of it before I buy and carry home another one.
So if you have annuals or small perennials that are finished blooming, and you know that sort of cutting off all that seed and seed heads and old flowers and potentially some of the early growth, that so like a pretty hard cutback of those, it's pretty soon for annuals in that, but some of your annuals might be ready for that kind of treatment. That's a really good time to be sure you fertilize, because you've taken off a significant amount of the plant. But a nice dose of fertilizer could really bring on that next flush of growth and a chance to rebloom yet this season. So if things are looking like they're not doing particularly well, or they're especially leggy and they're a plant that you can cut back, there's things like, I have some irises blooming on my deck, and a cutback in irises is not going to give you a second bloom. Most of the big perennials, you can't come back cut back and expect a bloom. You can deadhead along the way and hope that they will bloom a little longer, and that often works. But many of your annuals can handle the cut back and come again, including, I think, pansies and violas are okay with that as well if you don't take them down to the ground.
Yeah, so definitely trimming back those is a good idea. So maybe we've switched on again to, kind of trimming and that sort of maintenance. So the other bold thing I've been doing actually is pinching my seed-grown annuals back a little bit so that they branch. And I tell you, if you think thinning carrots is scary, oh my gosh, try pinching the top off of your snapdragon. It's just like, but I didn't do it on all of them. I started a ton of snapdragons this year. I have no idea why, probably time. And then I about maybe not even half of them I've pinched back. The ones that obviously already have blooms coming, I've left those, but I've pinched them back to see if maybe I can encourage more branching and a fuller plant and more blooms. But oh my gosh, that's frightening.
I feel the same way. I've done this with dahlias. So I grow my dahlias in pots, and oftentimes they'll put up a really strong central stem, the apical meristem part of the plant, and they'll have that big bud. And if you let that big bud grow, you're going to have a great big flower, which is very satisfying. But if you can manage before it gets very big to pinch that off, you'll have many flowers instead of just that one super robust one. So I've done that with my dahlias. And the other thing that I do that with is the calendulas that come from seed. They also like to create that first single bud, and they'll be good. They'll bloom from several side branches, even if you can't bring yourself to clip off that initial flower, that initial centralized bud. But that will get you there faster if you have the strength to do it.
Yeah, my goal for today is to prune back my dahlias that I started from seed this year. And actually, that was super easy. So if you ever get a chance to start dahlias from seed, I recommend it. But today, after the garden show, I'm going to go out there and be bold and give myself a nice chat up about pinching back those dahlias a little bit, so I avoid having this giant massive stem and I can have some smaller ones. I actually got this this idea was reinforced with me from this little it's like a flower growing selling company in Washington that had like a little free mini video that you could check out, and it's called the company's Florette. Anyway, so I want to give them their due, but I was like, it was very encouraging to, go and do this. And, she was mostly talking about plants that we don't grow here. We just can't grow them here. But the principle is the same. And she had a nice list of plants that you could do this with, things like cosmos and dahlia, snapdragons, sweet peas, things like that. So you could get more flowers out of your plants.
So in terms of being bold, I think it's also worth thinking about and talking about the idea that you're in charge. And early in the spring, you can't wait for your plants to grow big and robust. And now suddenly you look at your garden and it is so robust that things are crushing one another. And the most robust plants are crushing out other things. And so it's fine to say, I'm in charge here and I need to make room for the other things that are getting crushed out, and to cut things back either with a scissors or a pruners, or even dig out the edges of something to make room for other things. And then the other piece of this is, if something doesn't look healthy, don't wait. Take it out right now. So in my backyard, my columbines are absolutely stunning right now. I've grown columbines for years, and so they like to seed around and come up wherever, and I sort of selectively let the ones that are in the right place do that. I have a couple in the front by my walk, and they just do not look good at all. There's something that has either bothered them from a pest standpoint, or they just aren't making it. And I looked at them the other day and realized those really need to go. The whole plant, I need to take it out. And so just take a critical eye to your garden, and anything that doesn't look healthy, be sure and remove that, especially around things like, did you check your raspberries and is there a lot of rust? or some sort of a blight, those are places to say, oh, get this out now. And anything that you take out that doesn't look good and you're not, you know, and especially if it appears to be diseased or attacked by a pest, put that in the burn pile or the trash. Don't put that in your compost. All right. Kitty, how's it going on yours for anything that's being taken over or crushing out other plants? Okay, it appears that I might have lost Kitty. 747-5877 is the number if you have a question or you have a topic. We are going to try and get Kitty back on the line, so here's some music.
I can go. I'm running and running from all the things I know. Well, I had to leave it somewhere, so I left it far behind. I had to get away from all the trouble I might find. Run to the river, run to the sea. Run from the evil that's been calling you and me. If we keep rolling right out of town, we'll reach the promised land before they tear it down.
Right now. This is Molly. You're in the middle of the garden show with Kitty. Hello, Kitty.
Hello.
And there is still time for you to call 747-5877. Sometimes we end at 10:01. Today we will be wrapping up right at 10 a.m., but there's plenty of time for you to call. Again, 747-5877. And we have a caller that we're trying to have join the garden show. Kitty, how are the weeds going in your garden?
They're under control, but only because I go through and I probably weed like every week in my vegetable gardens, just a few. I try to get everything while it's really small, you know, pull up that remae and, you know, remove the chickweed and all that sort of stuff. So they're not too bad. I mean, I have a long-standing battle with the creeping buttercups and the bishop's weed. But those are more in the flower garden.
Okay. Hello, you're on the Garden Show.
Oh, hello, Molly. This is your neighbor, Amy.
Hello, and thanks for calling.
You've probably talked about this many times in the past, but I've missed it or forgotten it. What do you guys advise about managing or getting rid of horsetails?
Ah, horsetail. The hardest part with horsetail is actually, I mean, if you can keep it out of your garden from the get-go, I realize this is too late or you wouldn't be asking this question. But honestly, I just kept at it. I accidentally introduced it to my garden. And so I've just been steadily removing it. Actually, I think there's none up this year, so I think I might have won. But I kind of stayed on it a lot and especially tried to look for any of the roots, you know, those little underground stems, really the rhizomes. And just to be super careful and like beyond diligent. And mine did go away.
It is possible, but it's difficult. And I don't know anything else either. Just diligence of following every bit down into your beds that you can.
Okay.
I realize
yeah, we're a miracle.
We haven't found the miracle. If you do, be sure and let us know.
Okay.
One of the things I did do is I noticed when someone gives me a plant from their garden, I always put it in another pot. And I don't put it directly into the garden first. And I do that because, you know, they may have, they're your friends. They're not trying to give you weeds. but sometimes it happens, especially with something like horsetail that, you know, is below the ground. You can really, you know, it can end up in things. So I let plants sit in their pot for at least, I don't know, a season. I know that sounds intense. Before I allow them into my main bed. And then I will go through the soil and make sure nothing evil has come up and then put them in the bed. So I learned that the hard way.
Yeah, I think the other thing is to be thoughtful about where you get compost or other sources of soils that you don't really know where they came from. So if you're still on the line, thanks for your call. And good luck with horsetails. They are one of our toughest.
Yeah. Thanks, guys.
Yeah, the other thing. So last year, I also made use of the city's their free compost soil, which was great. But again, I put that in separate containers. You know, it was a big container and just kept it there while I grew potatoes in it. And it was just fine. But then I knew, you know, the city doesn't guarantee you don't have any weed seeds in there, of course. They can't. But it was great stuff in the end. But I did keep it sequestered.
The other thing to keep in mind is some of the, and we've talked about this before, some of the potting soils, particularly even more the manures, when you buy steer manure or chicken manure, they can have weed seeds in them. So be ready. It doesn't mean you don't want to use them because you may need that nitrogen-rich material to really give your garden enough nutrition. But that's sometimes a source of weed seeds as well. I suspect they're better than ever, but chicken manure used to be the worst. Very, very weedy stuff.
Yeah, I guess there are two reasons why I stopped buying and carrying chicken manure. One was because it was heavy and wet and yucky. And the other one was because of the weed seeds. I was just like, I don't need this kind of help. So I'm really hoping this granulated manure actually, you know, meets nutritional needs without being too strong. And it shouldn't have any weed seeds.
So another thing that we haven't touched on today, but we wanted to, was the idea that this is a good time to start another round of seeds for things that are fast growing. So if you're somebody who's trying to have fresh cilantro, it's sort of the worst culprit in bolting quickly, but there's nothing like fresh cilantro. So another round of seeding of cilantro, this is a good time for that. Same for, say, spinach and some of the other fast-growing greens, either lettuces, kales, and some of the other, the bok choys. This is a good time for them to be reseeded so that you have a new crop coming in.
Yeah, I started my second round of arugula, and that's slowly growing there. But I'm also going to plant probably in the next couple of weeks, actually, a round of broccoli, actually, for later harvest. Because I do have these, you know, big row cover spaces. And so, you know, I might be through my first round of broccoli, but then I'll have more later on for the fall. And then the other one I'm going to do that with is lettuce. I have like a boatload of lettuce right now, which is the one thing I was going to answer this question before my connection gave it up, was that my lettuce is actually, I planted them extra thick. And so I plan on pulling out the middle ones of that, you know, the ones that are causing the crowding, and eating those first. But I will start another round of the butterhead lettuce and the broccoli for later eating.
So two really great points there. One, if you're if you haven't thinned and everything is looking really tall, like it's reaching up for sunshine, that's because it is, because it needs room. You're not going to have good productivity in either carrots or radishes if you're still working on radishes, if they don't have what we call shoulder room. So if you think about the size of a carrot itself, it needs at least that much room on all sides of it to be, you know, to grow into a robust carrot. Otherwise, you're going to have little tiny thready things that are competing with one another. And it's the same with the greens. They'll grow, but they'll be tall and somewhat more spindly. And if you pull every other one, that's a great way to go. And the other thing is that now is the time. So many of our greens are optimal for eating, and they're only going to go downhill in terms of quality. They head toward not always. If they're growing robustly, you may be doing well. But if they seem like they're starting to bolt or really slow down, really go ahead and harvest them and eat them right now. That's it's so easy to let something go too far because you're waiting for it to be big enough.
Yeah, I've started eating my lettuce, even though it certainly could get bigger. It hasn't formed those big butterheads yet, but it's like I might as well eat some of it now because there's plenty out there growing. So yeah, replant, it's not too late. Sometimes I'll put mine, actually I'll start them in seeds instead of direct, or in seed trays instead of direct seeding for my second round, just because there isn't necessarily room right now. And I definitely have room for those seedlings in other places. So definitely go for that. One thing that came up, kind of, I'm going off on a little tangent here, but one thing that came up was like, what to do with all this rain, and what if your vegetables are slowing down or just not growing? You know, we're talking about like, oh yeah, our stuff's growing super well and it's growing so fast, we have to like go grab it and eat it. Well, if this is not your experience, my guess is you do not have Rime or row cover over your vegetables. And if not, this is a good time to invest in that stuff. It keeps things a little warmer and a little drier. And, you know, June has not been as kind to us as May was in terms of gorgeous weather. And it doesn't really look that great for the next week. So it's probably a good time to apply the row cover if you have not.
I did the experiment with the spinach, where I have some in with my garlic, and I don't have row cover on my garlic. Garlic's pretty robust and grows tall quickly. And so I left the row cover off once it was sort of brushing the top of it. And the difference between the spinach under the row cover right next door and the spinach amongst the garlic is really remarkable. So it was my own little experiment at home, and that row cover makes a really big difference. And I'm eating a lot of spinach right now. It will soon start bolting. And so it's perfect to be really eating that.
So one more thing I kind of wanted to talk about a little bit was, and I'm thinking about my tomatoes right now, and I realize I have tomatoes in the greenhouse, and not everybody has those, but still some of those same principles might apply to plants that you're growing outside, whether they're vegetables or flowers. So one of the things I like to do with my tomatoes is go in and check for any leaves that have like any signs of like fungal disease, you know, or, you know, any yellowing or little spots or things like that. And then I will remove those leaves. It's mostly show up in the lower leaves on the plant, not generally in the upper leaves. But I remove all those lower leaves that are even showing the faintest trace of that yellowing or those little fungal, they're usually kind of yellow dots or black dots with yellow halos. I'm not really that worried about which fungal disease is causing them because there's limited things that I'm going to do to it. But I do remove those leaves right away. You know, so I'll go through and trim all that, and I will take them out and put them in my burn pile. I'll do the same when I'm weeding, you know, my coal crops or whatever. I will look for damaged leaves or leaves that show some sign of something, and I'll get those the heck out of there. So it's not always the whole plant you're trying to remove. Sometimes it's just the affected foliage.
This weather also could easily bring on the molds and the rusts better than ever. And if you see that happening, you need to either thin and remove any plant that's looking diseased as soon as possible. That's what you're talking about. So I'm saying both, you know, the leaves, that works great, but also whole plants if necessary. Anything that looks diseased or not doing well is not going to do you any favors. And if it spreads whatever that problem is to your other plants, that's not helpful. So, you know, be tough and take those things out right away. The other thing is if you are growing in a greenhouse or in a cloche or some covered area with limited root run, check on whether or not you can still pot something on. So if you have been babying your tomatoes along and you have another big size pot, this is a great time to pot them on into a bigger size. Ultimately, you get to the place where you're at your limit of what you can manage or what you have for pots, and then that's fine. Then you're going to be managing nutrients. But if you can give as much root room as possible, this is a great time for it.
Yeah, that's one of the reasons why in particular this year, I keep adding like a low dose fertilizer because my tomatoes are definitely, they're not in giant pots. A couple of them are actually three of them are in 5-gallon buckets, the double self-watering buckets, but the rest are kind of in whatever I could come up with to fill with tomatoes. So they're smaller than really probably optimal. And they're not going to get potted on. It's just, you know, if I had bigger pots, I certainly would. But I'm also running out of space because I got a little hysterical with my tomatoes, too. And the problem with snapdragons, I have the same problem with tomatoes. There's like 14 tomatoes in that greenhouse. It's kind of nuts. I'm like, okay, whatever. So they're going to have to do with a little less space. So I have to be even more vigilant because the leaves are probably a little closer together. You know, I want to be super vigilant so I get maximum tomatoes. And right now I have baby green tomatoes, so I'm super excited about it. And now my goal is just to keep their water even and, you know, to watch for any signs of problems.
The other thing to take a check on if you haven't been out is your potatoes. So this is the time, of course, to keep hilling potatoes. And what we mean by that is building up the soil around the stems. The plants are going to produce those new potatoes between the seed potato you planted and the leaves at the top. So the most room you can give them in the soil along the stem, ideal. If you're growing in containers, or I have someone who's growing their potatoes in bags and they can just sort of roll up the top of the bag and put more dirt in, then that's ideal and you'll have the opportunity for more production. Again, checking on how's the watering going, how's the nutrition going, and also for pests. So the more time you can spend in your garden and amongst your flowers and plants, the more you're going to be aware of what you need and you'll be able to prevent something before it's pretty devastating. Well, Kitty, we're running out of time on this garden show. Thanks so much for joining me. And thanks to those of you who called. We hope you have a good week in the garden despite the forecast for pretty rainy skies. Kitty?
Yeah, so thanks again. Just spend, like Molly said, spend your time out in the garden and enjoy it as best you can, despite the crazy weather. There's always some joy to be gotten out of your garden. I'm sure of it.
All right, for The Garden Show, I'm Molly Kabler.
And I'm Kitty LaBounty.
This is KCAW in Sitka.
Raven Radio sounds pretty different now. That's because we care for the health and safety of our community, inside and outside of the studios. We'll be back to our locally hosted shows as soon as it's safe to do so. For now, know that KCAW is working hard to keep you informed of the evolving COVID-19 pandemic. You can turn to KCAW's reporting for clarity, truth, and the information you need in this time of uncertainty. You can also visit KCAW's Corona Hub at kcaw.org to find out the latest news and information about closures. KCAW can't do all this without you. Please make a gift today to support community radio that prioritizes your health, wellness, and safety. Go to kcaw.org right now to support KCAW. Programming on KCAW is provided by First Bank, helping customers access accounts easier with online banking, mobile check deposit, online bill pay, and more. First Bank, the one who's here. Member FDIC and equal opportunity lender.
KCAW Sitka.